Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of November. The poverty rate in Milwaukee is very high, and it keeps getting higher. Yesterday, the Social Development Commission had a symposium in this city, and it dealt with reducing poverty in a changing landscape. I guess the question of the hour is recognizing how high the poverty rate is and what can be done to change that. We have two guests with us. Deborah Blanks is Executive Director of the Social Development Commission. She's been there holding that position since 1997. And this is an organization that has been working. It has a very interesting board. We'll talk about how the members are comprised on the board, but they've been working to deal with social issues with poverty in this city for many, many years. Prior to joining SDC, Deborah was the City of Milwaukee Purchasing Director, and she has managed staff in the areas of procurement, accounts payable, inventory, material management. She has worked for Milwaukee County, Milwaukee Area Technical College, and for Cigna Corporation. She graduated from the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. She grew up in North Carolina, and she's a writer as well. Her bylines appear in the Business Journal, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Minority and Women in Business magazine, and the Milwaukee Courier. She writes poetry, plays, and books, and recently authored the book Weaving Diversity into the Fabric of America. Deborah, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank
you. Also joining us in our Milwaukee studios is Dave Salata. Dave is managing the Intergovernmental Affairs and Research Division at the Social Development Commission, the community action agency for Milwaukee County, overseeing several advocacy and engagement efforts at the agency, including studying poverty and related issues from a community-based perspective. He has a BA in political philosophy from George Washington University and a master's in public policy and administration from the University of Massachusetts, with a specialization in the all-important area of economic development, and he is from Boston. And thank you, Dave, very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Give us a picture, please, of poverty in the city of Milwaukee. How many people live in poverty right now? Dave?
Within the city, it's roughly about a quarter, a little over a quarter. One out of every four people are living in poverty within Milwaukee. That's heavily concentrated within the central city, of course. We have noticed in recent years, though, within Milwaukee County, there has been a spread of poverty. It's growing in the northwest side of the city. We're also seeing many traditional working class suburbs on the south side of Milwaukee, and even spreading into southwestern parts of the county. There's certainly growth there, and that's consistent with patterns that we're seeing throughout the country as suburban poverty has grown significantly. But despite that, it's still heavily concentrated and becoming even more concentrated within the central city, as a recent Brookings Institute research came out last week.
Deborah, the figure I saw concerning the number of children in poverty in this city is just astronomically high, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And unfortunately, that means that their parents aren't able to provide a family-supporting income and lifestyle that children need in which to nurture and grow and develop in the ways that we all want them to.
Mm-hmm. And we're living in a time nationally where the unemployment rate is incredibly high. The jobs aren't there. We hear again and again on this program of the number of manufacturing jobs that have left. Nothing is replacing them. So there's not a lot of movement to something better, is there? Can we find something better in this economic climate?
Well, I think we have to find something better. And that challenges us all to be creative and to think outside the box and understand that this issue didn't just appear 40 years ago when we were starting to lose the manufacturing base. Unfortunately, we as a community didn't say, okay, how do we help people transition from those good-paying jobs to a new job? And what will those jobs be? And how can we develop a community plan and really an economic development plan so that this community could continue to prosper? So we're really dealing with an issue that has been here for 40-plus years. I think, though, with the new technology and the new opportunities, it means that if we're truly interested about having all people who want to work be able to work, then we have to look at how do we train them for the jobs that exist. Because some people will say, there aren't jobs, and others would say there's a mismatch in the training and ability of workers with the opportunity. So we have to look at it from many different avenues.
What's the truth there? Are there jobs and there just aren't people trained for the jobs, or aren't there jobs?
Well, there are certainly opportunities out there. There is a skills mismatch that has been documented within certain areas, especially when it comes to advanced manufacturing, welding. That has been certainly well documented within the city, and then when you look at nationally, there is that mismatch. But of course, you don't have a 9% national unemployment rate without a simple dearth of jobs. So there are those both forces occurring simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. You had a major conference on this whole issue yesterday. Were there some absolutely outstanding, never before thought of ideas that were presented that everybody decided we've got to get moving on this?
Well, some of the most interesting things dealt with some very innovative approaches. A lot of conversation has centered recently on the concepts of sector blending and the ideas of having basically for-profit models that are working to achieve social good, the so-called fourth sector, which has its kind of its strengths and its weaknesses, but it does present an opportunity to venture into uncharted segments of the market, trying to address community needs and potential economic growth that can't be addressed by the simple for-profit or the traditional for-profit model or the traditional nonprofit model. Not saying that those aren't necessary. They're certainly essential components to any economy, to any society, but there is a potential to, again, get into uncharted segments of the market by kind of using the for-profit mechanisms and kind of the motivations of profit-seeking while also blending in more social good into those organizations. So it can be fourth-sector organizations, but then it can be also redefining what we mean by corporate social responsibility and looking at non-traditional functions in that area, not just simply cutting a check and walking away, but working closely and intimately with nonprofits and with community groups by providing technical assistance, sharing space, coming up with win-win projects that benefit both the business as well as the nonprofit or the community group.
Deborah, what does that phrase mean to you, corporate social responsibility?
Well, I think it has several meanings. One, of course, we want corporations to feel like they're a vital part of the community and that their work, not just what they do to make a profit, but their total inventory of work makes a difference to the community. And that means how do they invest? How do they contribute and donate funds to perhaps nonprofits and other communities or entities trying to do good? Do they volunteer in the community? How do they structure their hiring process? Are they open to many different people? Do they mentor those who may not be quite up to par? Do they really embrace the central city where many people in poverty live? Do they promote a fair and just society? For instance, if you look at the central city, there are many people who want to work, but they don't have jobs in the central city. So we're looking at people catching sometimes two buses and walking blocks to get to a job, or simply not having a reasonable transportation method to get to the job. Do we have a sense of corporate responsibility to help connect people to jobs? If we do, then that means we're going to look at ways in which to really make it a viable system so that the people who want the jobs can get to the jobs, even though many of those jobs are in outlying suburbs and adjacent counties.
Corporations have been taking a heavy rap, as you know, all over the country, all over the world for quite some time now with the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Milwaukee movements. Are they getting a bad rap? Is there a sense, do you have, in the city of Milwaukee, that there is a strong sense of corporate social responsibility and what Deborah just outlined is indeed happening, or are corporations woefully short in this vision?
We actually conducted some research about 4 or 5 years ago in interviewing corporate Milwaukee, and many of the responses that we received suggested that many corporations in Milwaukee want to do the right thing. The problem is they don't know what the right thing is to do. There are corporations, for instance, Manpower does a great job in working with us and many other community organizations. We have great relationships with many of the financial institutions centered around our free income tax preparation program, our car loan program, low-interest car loan program. We know that Greater Milwaukee Foundation, it's a corporation in some sense. They are one of the leading foundations. So, you know, unfortunately, I just named a few, but I do know that there are a lot of corporations that are great community citizens. And if we come together with a community plan and really talk about and dialogue about what else can they do, as well as what else can government and nonprofits, so we see ourselves not as adversaries, but as partners in making this community what we all want it to be. If we can do that, I think we'll see corporations step up even more.
Mm-hmm. So where do you take, this is such a huge problem, obviously. You mentioned transportation and buses and bus service being cut in some ways and people not having cars. And if the jobs are here or if they're in the suburbs, the list goes on, people perhaps not being trained for the jobs that are available. What would make the biggest difference in terms of getting people out of poverty, getting them to work in family-supporting jobs? Is it making sure that schools are training people for jobs, or is it, you know, transportation system? What is it? Is it everything equally?
Well, there's no silver bullet. There's no one thing that's going to cure all. So many of these issues are interwoven. But at the end of the day, the way I like to think about it is, poverty is quite simply about a lack of resources. You don't have enough resources to provide for yourself or for your family. And for most people, the way resources are brought into the household is through employment. You're going to have parts of the population, be it the elderly, children, people who have different physical and mental challenges, that employment isn't feasible. But for the overwhelming majority of the population, that's where the resources come into play. But, you know, so that's a simple answer. Well, we need more jobs. But then for all the other things that we've already brought up, transportation, education, skills mismatches, you know, the list goes on and on. It's very difficult to pinpoint one place where it needs to start. You know, I think more than anything, we need to really try to build in some areas of innovation. When you look at communities that do it right, that have low unemployment, that have a high quality of life, it's no coincidence that those communities also have very active universities, a significant amount of research and development that's occurring there. And as far as if we're just concentrating on Metro Milwaukee right now, I think the areas that we really need to focus our energy on is, where do we have those natural economic advantages here within the city? And, you know, the areas around water research, what the Water Council is doing, I think is definitely a good place to start, because all of a sudden all of that all the kind of the benefits of that research, whether it's manufacturing, the whatever comes out of the research and development, all of that ends up filtering down into creating an innovative community.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
When you mentioned these communities that may be doing better, where are those communities? Are they in Wisconsin? Are they in Michigan? Are they in Boston? Where are they?
Well, I mean, you know, within Wisconsin, certainly the greater Madison area is doing well. I haven't seen the unemployment numbers recently, but they're certainly lower than they are in Milwaukee and in many other places within the state. And I think that the impact of the university and its focus on research has certainly helped. The fact that, you know, that you've got the state government there certainly also helps to prop up the economy. And then when you're looking nationally, those cities and those metropolitan areas that have held up the best have been those that are constantly innovating.
Mm-hmm.
Just to return to that word, developing new technologies, having high-paid, high-skilled jobs, all of that allows you to kind of weather the storm, especially when you have a diversity of an economy. You're not focusing on one area.
Deborah, can we do the mission of trying to lower the poverty rate with what we have, or is there a new vision needed, as has been discussed for the Midwest, that we need to attract a whole different kind of industry, that we need to bring green energy here, or we need to bring, I don't know what it is, but something that isn't here now needs to come?
Well, when Dave talks about innovation, I think that suggests that, yes, we need to bring new industry here. And I would agree with that idea, but I also think that we need to really look at what we have here and perhaps how we value it more. Because if you look at one thing that may sound simple to do is if we could just strengthen the family base here in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our research has talked about education, employment, innovation, asset development is critical. But another part of the research that we've conducted suggests that one of the key points in helping families move out of poverty is family strengthening. That means you give those families more skills, capacity, ability, strengths to really help themselves move out of poverty. You lessen their stress. You give them ways in which to deal with conflict, to improve maybe their sense of hope, their view of their environment. And so you improve the relationship between the father and the mother, whether they are acting as a couple and together in the home or outside. Because the data really shows that when children don't have two parents in their lives are disrupted and they have a sense of hopelessness and they have low self-esteem. But if you can give those children a feeling that both parents are co-parenting and actively working to cooperate in the development of their children, then that in itself helps the family. So we can look at many different ways in which to help families move out of poverty.
And the figures I was looking at yesterday that show the poverty rate for women who are raising mm-hmm. children on their own, and there are a lot of families in that category in this city, the poverty rate is much, much higher, isn't it?
It's much, much higher. And family strengthening and bringing in the father and recognizing the role of the father and validating and valuing the father is something that oftentimes we haven't done. If you look at the research, you will find that in the 1960s, in black families, the two-parent family households were over 69%. If you look at the data today, it will suggest probably about 29%. And black men just didn't wake up one morning and decide they didn't want to be an integral part of the family and society. We had welfare laws and other disincentives for the family to stay together as a unit. And now we have the message of deadbeat dads that further alienate men. And we have to say that men are valuable to the lives of their children. And for me, it's not that the couple has to be together in a relationship in the home, but they have to figure out how to co-parent. The other issue is when that doesn't exist and the likelihood of the parents not working together is there, then we have to look at what can we do to help support single-parent households. And there are many things that can be done as far as supporting the idea of education, figuring out how we as a community provide male role models to the children. There are a lot of things we can do under that umbrella of innovation, whether it's looking at the family or looking at industry.
We also have to have, let me ask kind of an amorphous question here, but it seems to me as though we have to have a will to take on this issue, too. And I don't see much of that will. I don't see many people talking about poverty in this city or in this state. I don't see much of this visionary thinking about how we can get people out of poverty. It's sort of, well, you know, there it is.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is it just didn't happen in the last 5 years, though I have to say the whole national climate of such anger and adversarial conversations doesn't help that process. But even if you look at the time when President Reagan was in office, he termed the idea, the phrase of the truly needy. And some days for his agenda, the truly needy were the elderly. Other days it was the children. Some days it was people with disability. It really fit his agenda. President Nixon and some of his staff talked about the undeserving poor. And that phrase, an underclass, has been perpetuated by political officials as well as social scientists. And what is created in this country is this sense of if you're Black or Latino and poor, there must be something wrong with you. You lack morals, you lack values, you don't want to be successful. And so now we have in too many minds the idea of you're poor because you don't care or you don't work hard enough. And what that does is it definitely puts in front of us the idea of personal responsibility, which is important, but it really erases off the conversational table the idea of societal responsibility. And many of the things that create poverty have to do with policies, procedures that may have been well-intentioned but unintentionally created an environment of poverty, of the breakdown of the family. And so we really need to first understand that most people, regardless of race, creed, ethnicity, and all of those things we use to divide, most parents want to provide strong lives for their children. Most adults want to have good jobs. Most people want to be contributors to their environment, to their community, to society.
Mm-hmm. That's a great answer. We go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We have one of those, so feel free to use the email if you'd like. We have two guests with us as we look at poverty in the city of Milwaukee, which is going up and not going down. We have two guests with us, Deborah Blanks, who is CEO of the Social Development Commission, author of Weaving Diversity into the Fabric of America. Also joining us in our Milwaukee studios, Dave Salata. He is the manager of the Intergovernmental Affairs and Research Division at the Social Development Commission. To your phone calls in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program this Thursday, Chris Matthews will join us. Chris has written really a very thorough book about Jack Kennedy. It is titled Jack Kennedy, an Elusive Hero. He says his fascination with the elusive spirit of Kennedy has been an abiding one. He's both avatar and puzzle, a beacon and a conundrum. Whenever I spot the name in print, he says, I stop to read. Anytime I've ever met a person who knew him, someone who was there with JFK in real time, I crave hearing his or her first person memories. And many of those memories are in this very thorough book. And Chris will be an engaging guest. He's like my long-lost Irish cousin, who may talk too much, but he's a lot of fun. And he knows his history. So we'll have a good time with Chris, hour number two. We go to phone calls now. Lori in Viroqua, our first caller. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Good morning. I'm so glad you're talking about this subject, and I'll try to be coherent. In the late 1990s, I was a graduate student, and I was working. I observed a lot of the repercussions of what happened when, or some of them, not a lot of them, when Clinton and Thompson eliminated AFDC and replaced it with all the work fair and the bride fair and whatever else they were talking about. And the message that they were getting was that any job is better. That is more important than raising children. So they had women in you know, counting pogs, you know, the game pieces, and you know, just, and they privatized so much of the services to families and to women, and they made it so complicated that so many people were just lost from receiving any government help. And the people behind that, and in the think tanks, you know, the Bradley Foundation, they are the same ones who are coming up with they're the same ones involved in the ALEC legislation and the privatizing of schools. And so when and they're not being held accountable for their ideas, you know, 15 years ago, and so the poverty rate has increased, and the lives of people have been so damaged, and now we're blaming it on the teachers, you know, that the schools aren't doing enough to clean up the mess, and so they're just trying to privatize the next, you know, now they're trying to privatize everything else. So, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Lori. Deborah.
Well, I would agree that if you look at Clinton, and he did some marvelous things, but when he looked at welfare, he really, in many ways, mirrored what was happening in the early 1700s, and that is, we looked at, as Americans, the English poor laws, and the English poor laws looked at the poor as unworthy and set criteria that you needed to meet in order to prove your worthiness. Years and years, decades later, Clinton, in his development of the welfare, really looked at how do you move people off the welfare laws. But what the caller mentioned is true. We didn't provide for transportation. We didn't provide for education. We didn't think long-term about the impact of women working in very low-paid, menial jobs. And while, yes, everyone wants a job, also people want a future. They want a career path. They want to see that job gets them to somewhere else. And so, again, well-intentioned but with poor consequences.
Mm-hmm. And we may want to spend a minute or so on this because there are a lot of people in this city who are working jobs that pay virtually nothing. And to take care of your family, a lot of people are working two jobs. It's just a really hard life. If you're going to work, you need to be able to make enough money so that you can put food on the table and have a place to live. And for a lot of people, it's a struggle to work.
It's a struggle to work, and then we wonder why, if you're working two jobs, why you can't make the teacher's conference, or right, your children are at home alone, and what is that impact? And again, you know, too often we're ready to blame because we don't want to hold the responsibility. And what that often ends up with is we're blaming each other, but we're not having the valuable conversations that says, what are the resources everyone can bring to the table? How can we hold people who are living in poverty accountable and responsible for their lives, but also recognizing that there are things society has put in the place as in their way as barriers? How do we tear down those and make this playing field really a level one? Until we have that kind of conversation, or until enough of us come together and have those serious, difficult conversations, we may continue to spin our wheels.
Yeah. Let's go next to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Problem's been a long time in the making, and I'm afraid it needs a radical solution because from what I've heard so far, it's like a shotgun effect. You know, they're trying to address everything, and in the end, get very little results because of the shotgun effect. So perhaps a radical thought, a radical idea. Let's take a group of these kids, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, but whatever that number is, and not separate them from their families, but give them a place to be, to live, and educate them, because the solution, obviously, is education. And every year, increase that number by 10%. At least in the long term, will solve the problem.
Take them where? To a school somewhere? Or live-in situation?
Maybe a boarding-type school situation, you know, paid for by the state.
Okay, what about a boarding school?
Well, that has been tried, and in some cases that's a good idea, to take children and let them be in that environment as long as their parents are encouraging that and supportive. But my concern is that too often we as a society look at especially people of color and say, let's take their children somewhere else. And the reality is whatever we might think of families, most children love their families. They love their mothers, their fathers, their grandfather, fathers and mothers, their nieces, their cousins, they love to argue, they love to laugh and play. And so we need to be concerned about the implications of taking children away from their families, because unless we plan for them never to go back to the families, because you always return, usually, to your family. So I would promote more focus on how do we help those families be what they need to be. And that starts not just with education, but with employment. It starts with family supporting jobs. It really looks at income as one ingredient. But unless we help families understand that they can build assets that you can pass from one generation to another, we'll continue to have this problem. Most successful families have people in their families that help them build and develop assets and pass them through generations. And that's just another piece of it. I would promote a focus on families. And how do we support those families to be able to be self-sufficient?
I know that you're looking at a new model, and you were at your conference, but there has been a debate in this country, as you well know, for quite some time about whether or not we really do need some more public funds to rebuild infrastructure, to rebuild homes that have been foreclosed on, and there are many of them in the city of Milwaukee. Is that a part of the component here? Are you fighting for more money for, you know, a New Deal kind of let's put people to work and let's have our taxpayer dollars do just that?
Well, the conversation yesterday centered on those things that we could agree on, because for the past several months, few years now, there has been this animosity of going back and forth, and we wanted to have at least one day where we could come together, talk about some things that a lot of people, that could get us some traction. But at the same time, we can't ignore the role of government, be it at the local level, state level, and federal level. And when it comes to addressing poverty, there are certainly things that can be done by corporations, by nonprofits becoming more efficient, by foundations working closely with community groups. But at the end of the day, the actions at the local and state level, but mostly at the federal level, is what's going to allow us to get the furthest along, be that a structuring of the tax code through certain, you know, real incentives that have been proven to work with the EITC. So when we were talking earlier about jobs and some jobs just don't pay, well, we have to have it built into the tax code that allows somebody, if you're out there working full-time and in some cases working multiple jobs, you shouldn't struggle to be able to put a meal on the table at the end of the day, or put a roof over your child's head. So those various incentives have had widespread bipartisan support. But more to your point, we could get really far along down that road if there was some sort of a complete bipartisan comprehensive agreement to really once and for all not kind of nitpick at the edges of the foreclosure issue, but dive headfirst into a solid long-term fix. When you look at public infrastructure, that's certainly going to help when it comes to addressing the poverty rate, because a lot of the people that are unemployed currently aren't those that have, you know, we're not talking about doctors, we're not talking about engineers, we're talking about people that were from the construction industry that has never bounced back from the foreclosure crisis. We're talking about people that could really benefit from those public infrastructure investments.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in from George in Milwaukee. Both state and national Republicans are moving toward reducing the earned income credit refund that many poor working people currently receive. Could you talk about how important it is to keep this program at its current level and hopefully even expand it?
Well, 10 years ago, SDC started our VITASITES, our Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, and what we have found out over the last 10 years is that the results of that program has meant we processed over 100,000 tax returns at no charge to people. We also have helped them bring in about $120 million to this community, going back into the hands of workers, of employees. that means they're bringing that money back to spend in this community. So they're really helping infuse quite a large number of funds into the community. We know that attached to that kind of program, we promote the homestead credit, the earned income tax credit. We promote getting that refund and getting banked. So you have a bank account, you establish your credit. We talk to them about joining with organizations that have individual development accounts so they can save $1,000 and perhaps also earn $1,000 for a child's education or for a computer or a down payment on a car so they can get to the job. It might not sound like a lot to some people when you get that tax return, but we know people who have gone through this program and used the earned income tax credit being able to put that down payment on the home or start to look at their future in a different way. And so I think earned income tax credit not just helps the individual family, but the community, and it starts changing the mindset of people who haven't had financial literacy education and just makes them feel a more part of mainstream society.
Right. Let's go next to, where are we? George, another George, Springdale Township. Hi, George.
Hi. Very good discussion this morning. I've worked on poverty issues, especially related to child care, now for about 20 years in Dane County. And the one thing that I really noticed with welfare reform is that and it took a long time for me to figure this out, is that the basic formulas don't take into account local cost of living. And so within the state, you have an incredibly wide, I took a look at the self-sufficiency studies, and basically within the state, you have an incredibly wide range of cost of living, from rural areas, which are maybe, you know, way below the norm, to places like Madison and Milwaukee, which have far higher cost of living, and therefore the formulas don't work. In our areas, basically, people lose their child care subsidies and lose, in some cases, their health care subsidies before they can pay for their rent and all that type of thing out of their pocket. So you basically get into the cycle where people start out, get a job, and even a low-wage job, and are getting stable, and then suddenly they max out on their benefits and they crash within two or three months, which further disrupts the family and further causes problems. And also, what's more tricky on this is that this divides the state into a worthy poor and an unworthy poor, because the formulas quite often will work. And if you look at the places which were sort of model welfare reform counties where all these successes were happening, they fall in the formula in the income ranges where it actually works. And those areas are predominantly white. And the areas where it predominantly fails have larger numbers of low-income Black and Latino people. The other problem with welfare reform is that it is not a subsidy for the poor. It's a subsidy also for business. But we don't require business to give anything in return except a job. And we don't even require the quality of that job. And I say that because in 1995, when we were fighting on this issue, the concern was people going into full-time, low-wage employment and not getting anywhere. Today, if you look at the charts and you look at the data, what you're going to find, especially at least in Dane County, is a large quantity of our child care subsidies and other subsidies are going to subsidize people in less than full-time employment. So in many cases, we're paying out a huge amount of money to basically keep people in very low-wage jobs on which a large amount of profit is made without any requirement that those jobs be made full-time or that they're tied into any type of a scale. So I suggest that I think a really key issue that we've got to look at as part of this, because the backside of that is that all that money that's not going into Milwaukee County and Dane County to fund child care and health care then gets backfilled by either local governments or higher costs to other people, which then raises the cost of development. So we're in this incredible cycle that if we don't change the policies, we aren't going to solve the problem.
I'm glad you called, George. Yeah. Deborah.
Well, I wish I had said what he just said, because I'm very impressed by it. But, you know, he talked about the point of people who are getting these low-paying jobs having to then get pay for child care and those kinds of things, and they get less government support, and it does act as a disincentive because people are saying, I've increased my stress, I'm away from my children, I've increased the cost, the support has diminished or almost evaporated, and so I'm not doing better. I'm just treading water, and I'm treading water with more responsibilities and less time at home with my children, and so does it make sense? Again, the idea is if you want people to really work hard to move ahead, it makes sense that they have incentives, that they have hope. And when I say that, I'm sure that many people, regardless of socioeconomic status, would question where they are working if they felt like they were losing money by working instead of gaining. But we don't look at that except for people who are in poverty because we don't want to hear their voices. We think their voices are full of excuses, even when they're being pragmatic. Mm-hmm. But many people would look at that and say, what's the cost benefit? What's the return on investment of me investing all my time here? And how do I get ahead?
Mm-hmm. George, are you still working in this area?
Yes, I am, yeah.
All right. Send us more information about what you're doing.
I'll send off the studies, too. I mean, it's stuff I did internally here, but it's I think, a really core issue that people don't look at because, you know, right. A large chunk of these folks who are especially migrating to Madison, and in some cases, because I grew up in Chicago on the South Side, are migrating to Milwaukee for a better life. And then they basically are pushed down back into poverty. And the reason is that we're subsidizing them to work, which is actually a subsidy. I mean, if you look, for instance, at Dane County, we've got chain stores, small chain stores in almost every neighborhood. And if you look then on the Badger Care list, those chain stores have some of the highest numbers of people on Badger Care in the state. And so we have that subsidy, but we don't really require anything from those people, mm-hmm. I mean, from the corporations. And so we set up, and the people who really suffer then are the families, and especially the children, because the children mm-hmm. don't have the support at home, and, you know, you're dealing with all the social problems that come out of that.
So we're interested in your work. Send it to me, and we'll pass it along, too, because it sounds important. You know, as he was talking, I was thinking, how many studies have we even seen to see how this whole thing is working? What we've done is, well, we tackled that problem. Let's move on. It's over now. It's really not over now, is it?
It's not over now, and I think one of the things George suggested is that as we tackle these problems, we have a tendency when they fail to blame the individual, that it's the individual's fault, without saying who designed this plan and was it properly implemented and did it really achieve the goals that it was designed to achieve? And if not, how do we either tweak it, refine it, or get rid of it and start new?
And is anybody looking at that question? Did it achieve the goals? That's an important question.
Well, I think a lot of people are looking at it. And for instance, Dave mentioned the Brookings Institute. I know there are other national entities such as Casey takes a look at issues impacting poverty, and they talk about economic security and how you help revitalize families and neighborhoods. The question, though, is oftentimes not, you know, we can identify the problems, but we need the community to come together. And that's what's missing in so many cities is that community will that you mentioned earlier. Where's the community will? And that has to be more important to us to create a society, a community where all people have the opportunity to prosper and not just look at people as they're lazy, they don't care.
And to add on to that, when it comes to did it succeed or not and what has the research found out, it comes down to the question of what was the goal, what was the outcome of welfare reform and of TANF. If it was to reduce the welfare rolls, well, then it succeeded. The rolls have gone down. If it was to move people into jobs, then to a certain extent it succeeded. But was that the goal of welfare? Perhaps, or welfare reform, rather. Perhaps for some groups it was. But I really think that the goal should have been to improve the quality of life of low-income Americans and to reduce poverty. So to get to that even deeper level of what that impact has been, I haven't seen a really good comprehensive study on that per se. But again, at the end of the day, when you're evaluating the program, you know, it comes down to what was the goal.
Right. We welcome more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about poverty in Milwaukee. The Social Development Commission had a major conference on this yesterday, reducing poverty in a changing landscape. And we have two guests with us in our Milwaukee studios. Deborah Blanks is CEO of the Social Development Commission, and Dave Salata is the Intergovernmental Affairs and Research Division Manager at SDC. And here's our phone number. Our lines have been crowded. You can get through right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to, you can use that, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Thursday, Chris Matthews will be joining us. His latest book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Back to phone calls. Ken in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was shocked to find out recently that if someone is going to school full-time and trying to retrain, they inevitably will lose their benefits or will have them greatly reduced. And I thought that, especially with all that is being made as far as going back to school, retraining for new economies, et cetera, this is so backwards. And is this true? And if so, what can someone do in order not to have that happen?
Well, I believe in some cases, I don't have the definitive answer, I have to admit, but that was an issue that came up several years ago when the welfare laws were changed and people were really protesting and objecting to this idea of a lack of focus and funding for child care and a lack of focus on education and training. And so we've heard the stories of people where when they go back to school, their benefits are cut. I think that's changed, though, over the last several years where there's more focus on promoting education. But I'm not the one to give you that definitive answer. But I do know that people are struggling to even be able to, when they have benefits, still find the time to take care of all the requirements that they need to do in order to continue to receive benefits and achieve that education.
Is there a lot of retraining going on in this city?
There's a lot of discussion about the need for retraining. I don't know, though, that there's a massive focus on retraining. A lot of discussion, but when you're talking about retraining, for instance, there are companies that there was a real push for welding. There was a real push for more people to go into nursing. There was a push for child care. And I think we have to be careful when we do that, because if we're not giving people, for instance, in child care, many daycare centers opened up. A lot of women on welfare saw that as a way out. I'll start my business. But we see that the results of that, the quality is uneven.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really need to think seriously about that.
We go next to John in Eagle River. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. How are you?
Good. Yeah, two or three issues that I'd like your guests to comment on. I worked in the poverty programs from the mid-60s to the early 80s, and I still do some translations for documented and undocumented workers from Mexico who are hurt in accidents. So I still have my hand in it, in a sense. But now I'm 69 and on a, you know, low income, and so as my friends used to say, you know, in terms of their being poor, he says, now I is one, and I am, of course. But there's a very interesting thing under Walker that Walker did. I'm on a, what's called a senior care program, where I get some subsidy for my medication, which if I had to pay full price, it would be $1,300 a month. And he adopted for people on senior care and Badger Care a one-strike-and-you're-out policy where if you miss a payment, you're off the program and you don't get back on. And, you know, a lot of people more socially disorganized than I am would be missing, poor people would be missing payments all over the place and get pushed more into poverty and, you know, bad health care because, no health care, rather, because they might have missed a payment. And so that one strike and you're out policy seems crazy. I just experienced it.
John, we're going to have to stay we'll have to stay with issue one because we have only about 45 seconds left. We haven't even touched on health care.
Right. You know, oftentimes we look at people living in poverty as if they're different from the rest of us. A lot of us make poor financial decisions. It's just that if I blow $50, it doesn't impact me to the degree of if someone who's struggling to survive blows that. A lot of us are challenged with our credit and making good financial decisions, but we can rebound. One payment missed and you're out. People across the economic spectrum miss payments. And so that is one of those issues where we've got to think about this a little bit more compassionately if we're really trying to help people move ahead. We can hold them accountable, but we don't want to take away those opportunities that really not just help the family, but help the community as well.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Keep us informed. Let us know what's going
on.
We'll do more stories. Our guest this hour, Deborah Blank, CEO of the Social Development Commission in Milwaukee, and Dave Salata is the manager of the Intergovernmental Affairs and Research Division, also at SGC. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll do follow-up stories on this. We've done a lot of shows on what's going on nationally and internationally. We probably should do more on what's going on in our state. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your calls and for listening. Chris Matthews following the news.